Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Room 42. I'm Liz Fraley from Single Sourcing Solutions. I'm your moderator. This is Janice Summers, our interviewer, and welcome to Heidi Lawrence, today's guest in Room 42. Heidi is an associate professor in the Department of English at George Mason University. She was the first sponsor of TC Camp East. Just want to throw that right in there. So she's been a favorite of ours for a very long time. She's currently working on how the tools of rhetoric can be used to better understand and respond to controversial topics about science and medicine in the public sphere. Her monograph, Vaccine Rhetorics, explores what she calls the four primary material exigencies that facilitate and sustain discord about vaccines. She looks at disease, eradication, injury, and the unknown. Vaccine Rhetorics draws upon interviews with adults, physicians, as well as textual media analysis to examine why our language about vaccines becomes so very heated. She continues to look at language, how it functions as both a space for understanding controversy, as well as an ameliorative path to changing controversial issues in the public sphere. Today, she's here to help start answering the question, how do you keep going when the book writing process doesn't look the way you imagined it would? Welcome.
Thank you so much, Liz. I really appreciate it. And in the spirit of full disclosure and giving credit where credit's due, Rachel Graham Lussos was really the spearhead for TC Camp East. So I don't want to take any credit from Rachel. Shout out as always to Rachel.
Absolutely.
It takes a village, right? It takes a village. But Heidi, we're very excited to have you here today. And so first, I kind of want to start out, just jump in if you don't mind. What inspired you? Now, the title of your book is Vaccine Rhetoric.
Yes.
What inspired you to write this book?
So a lot of different things. I'll start topically. So I started my PhD in 2009. Which was right at the in the midst or in the beginning of the 2009-2010 H1N1 flu pandemic, which now feels like a happy memory compared to where we have been and the real, not to make light of it, the real devastation that has happened in this past year. Yeah. And so at the time, right, there was this big question. You know, who's going to get the vaccine? They did roll out an H1N1 specific vaccine for that strain that circulated and created those higher rates of incidence of disease. Mm-hmm. Lots of people were reporting adverse reactions. People were saying they didn't want to get it, that it was too new. And I was at the time a research assistant as part of my graduate program, and I ended up supporting a professor, Bernice Hausman, who was interested in this phenomenon of why people would refuse a vaccine in the midst of really exigent circumstances. Mm-hmm. And so that was really where the research started. And at the time, it seemed like, oh, wow, we really should solve this problem about why people are so concerned about vaccines if there's ever a pandemic. And then now we're in the midst of that now. And so what I ended up kind of taking away from that project was this question of ultimately professional and technical communication, which hadn't, as I sort of saw the research that had been done on vaccine refusal, wasn't something that had totally addressed that area. As a technical communicator myself in a prior life, I really saw the question of how to communicate with people about vaccines as a question that technical communicators are always dealing with. How do you communicate really advanced technical knowledge to a public with a wide range of backgrounds, knowledges, concerns, things that you can't anticipate? So it's not unlike the user manual that all technical
communicators do. Yeah, a lot of similarities, right? Because you're making it complex, simple, and you're making it not only just so that they can comprehend it, but that they can embrace it, right? Because that's when you're talking about we need to change a behavior or a belief, then we need to show you why, and we need to explain it in a way that is comfortable for you so that you can integrate it. Right.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And so it was sort of I realized how much I had that investment in the project when I started talking to doctors and realized they had the same problem that my SMEs on site had communicating engineering information or risk communication about a terrorist attack or whatever different contracts I had worked on. They were saying the same problems. Right. Why can't I know everything about this? Why can't I get people to read my writing? Why can't I get people to understand what I'm communicating? It was the same refrain, just a different set of topics. And so that was really one of the things that drew me to the topic and the book.
And it's really interesting that you refer to doctors as SMEs, right? Because we always think engineers as SMEs, but you know they're very much the same type of people, right?
Yeah.
It just tickled me a little because you know when you think about how sometimes it's challenging, right? Because that's part of the job of a technical and professional writer is to translate engineer speak into, you know, common user speak. So
it's interesting. Point there, because you're right, because at least we sort of know the problem in a technical writing environment. Like we have technical writers there because we know we can't expect the same engineer to build the circuit as we can expect them to communicate everything to every possible audience about the circuit, right? Or at least that's an established problem that we know it would be helpful to have some communicators in on the process to make that better.
Right,
doctors are faced with a really interesting challenge where they have this, they're, you know, have a lot of scientific knowledge, but ultimately medicine is an art and an interpersonal communication event. And they don't have tech writers on staff going, you know,
they should.
If up that language, they absolutely should.
They need technical and professional writers. They should, because it would really be very helpful, because you want your doctor to be technically brilliant, right? So right. It's okay if they're not the best communicators, as long as they're technically brilliant, right?
Yeah, but yeah, what do we, right? We evaluate them oftentimes on like bedside manner, which is really just another word for a combination of communication and expertise and how we're meant to feel in their presence and those types of things. So it's an interesting kind of gap in the medical system in terms of how we interact with physicians and what we expect of them versus other types of technical experts.
That's true. That's true. Because we don't put that same burden on engineers.
No.
Or when we do, we know that it's not going to go well.
Right. We never rate our engineers on bedside manner.
That's true.
So now let's talk about, your book is available, right? Okay.
Yes. It was published by Ohio State University Press. Huge thanks to them. It's available through their website and on Amazon.
Okay, good. And we'll make sure everybody's got a link to it. So now let's go into the like way back and let's talk about how did you start the process? Like what was your methodology in starting the process?
Yeah, it was really difficult as we were talking in the lead up to this conversation. It was a much more arduous path than I anticipated it be or would be. And then I was kind of told that it would be earlier in my career.
Told it wouldn't be easy.
Yeah, no one ever said like, oh, it's really easy, but no one ever really said it was going to be as hard as it wound up being, or at least as hard as it wound up being for me. So full disclosure there.
Yeah, let's talk about what you thought it would be like and then what reality was.
Yeah. So for non-academics in the audience, academic jobs usually, you know, they involve the tenure process, and at different institutions, they require different types of things. At Mason, it's an R1 institution. So I had to write a book for tenure, and tenure being keeping one's job. So you don't really get, sorry, my cat is right behind my screen right now. I just had to sort of.
Okay. I have cats that thankfully are playing in the other room and not climbing their cat pole that's right behind my head.
It's always such a tough thing. Do you kick them out and then they scratch at the door the whole time? Or do you leave them in and then they bump your computer screen when you're trying to talk? So tenure is really like the process of keeping your job. Like you don't get to not get tenure and keep your job. So I had to write a book in order to keep my job. Mm-hmm. And so when I took the job, I was sort of advised, you know, you wrote your dissertation, you contact a couple of presses, your dissertation is basically the first draft of your book. See which press is interested, make some revisions, and voila, you've got a book in, you know, 9 to 18 months, right? Very simple. I had what I thought was and was reasonably, you know, a good dissertation. It was sort of conceptualized as a book, I thought, at that juncture, and it won an award. So I thought like, oh, this is going to be really easy. And, you know, as I started reaching out to presses, I found that they were really happy to take a look at the book. They were interested in the topic, but really reshaping the book for a book audience was much more difficult than I thought it was going to be. going through the reader review process was a lot longer and more winding than I thought it would be. And ultimately, it wasn't really until I found a home with Ohio State University Press and my editor there that I could really see the path forward. And so, you know, I kind of envisioned it being this solo act of revision. And really, it was this like entirely networked path of reiterative editing and help and all kinds of things that you just don't think of as a book writing process.
Yeah, because, you know, other people don't see things the same way that you do. And getting those, so you had like a team of people that were previewing and reading this and saying, no, this, you know, adding comments and pulling more information from you and shifting your perspective then, right?
Yeah. So for at least for my process, and I think most book first books, second books and subsequent, I think you get a little bit more leeway. But the first book process was really about, you know, reaching out to the editors with a book proposal mm-hmm. and them giving you some feedback. And then for me, they wanted to see a full manuscript next. So you kind of provide a plan and then you have to do the plan. And then it goes out for peer review like any other journal article does. Mm-hmm. And for me, my first round of reviewers were really mixed. I had one person who was like, this is excellent, fix up this, change that, consider this, like very kind of run-of-the-mill feedback. And then another reviewer who really wanted to take the project in a completely different direction, like a totally a different set of research questions, problems, et cetera. And, you know, I ended up going forward with those revisions. In the end, it took about 2 years to do those revisions. It included massive overhaul of the book and an additional chapter with some new data and research in it. I also had a baby in that time frame, so I had a few months where I didn't
do anything. A little bit of time.
Yeah. And ultimately, you know, I said, okay, I think this is what you want. I think this is what this person wants. So let me send it back to them. And I actually never ended up finding out because that person delayed and delayed and delayed and didn't respond to the request for feedback and just was probably busy with other things. And so it's one of those examples where like the most important thing in your life is the least important thing in someone else's life.
Yeah, my urgency isn't somebody else's urgency.
Absolutely. And the whole book process is filled with that, where like, again, like my whole job and what very much I think felt to me like my whole life. I mean, I'd gotten a PhD, I'd gotten a job. My whole existence, it felt like, relied on this book.
Well, and a lot's hinging on it. Your tenure is hinging on this book.
Yeah, so, yeah.
So I can imagine the weight of it and the pressure of it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It felt like, yeah, everything was waiting on it. And yet like to other people, it's just like one more task that they don't have time to do, which is also very reasonable. And we're all really busy. And so I ended up sort of pulling the book from that press, which was scary to do. I was pretty far along. I'd been at Mason. You have roughly 5 to 6 years to complete your tenure requirements. So you're time constrained there. And I had a, thankfully to Mason, they were amazing. I had an extra year in my tenure clock because I had a baby. I had a great maternity leave. I had lots of privileges that other people don't have access to. So I want to acknowledge that Mason is really a great support in that way.
Right.
But, you know, the time was like kind of
still
hitting.
Time ticks.
Yeah, time ticks. Yeah. And luckily, I reached out to Tara and Tara Lee Kiefers at Ohio State. And she read it and said, I think this is good, but I think all of this revision you did is not right. Like this is right. Like I can see what you've tried to do.
Wait, you just spent 2 years.
Yeah.
Wow.
Revisions from the very difficult reviewer.
Mm-hmm.
All those revisions. Then that person goes missing.
Mm-hmm.
Then you send it to somebody new who's like responding and saying, yeah, okay, I'm not gonna, you know, but all these revisions, no.
Yeah. Yeah. She just was like, we'll see, but I understand why you didn't do this to begin with. And I think that these revisions were probably not the best choice. And so she really believed in me and believed in the project. And so that's the way in which, like, you know, you need other people in ways that you just don't know. I didn't know I needed a reviewer who believed in me as a part of this process or an editor. And there would be
really quick, and one of the words of advice that you would give to people who are aspiring to write a book or to write, basically, I think write anything, that they should possibly like interview different publishers, right? And find the one that believes in them. And just because somebody doesn't believe in you doesn't mean that everybody doesn't believe in you.
Absolutely. Keep going, persevere. Yeah. Find someone who understands your project, what you're trying to do, who believes in you. Don't go with just like the first option, the first person who says yes, right? I mean, you might have to, right? But, mm-hmm. but you know, don't just say like, and that kept me like working that other system longer than I should have, because I just kept thinking like, I can do what they need me to do. I can do this. And really like the project couldn't do it. The project didn't support what that was and mm-hmm. what that person really felt like it needed to be. And what the editor in turn was convinced it could be as well. My husband also always says that it was like that classic example of bring me a rock. Right. And then, you know, bring me a rock. Oh, no. I want a big rock. And then you bring it back. No, not that big. And then you bring it back. No, sharper. No, smoother. No, gray. No, brown. Right. I was in this space through this back and forth on the manuscript and the revisions where I was like, just tell me what you want me to say and I'll say it. And it wasn't until I kind of realized that no one could tell me that. No one could tell me what the book was going to say. I had to figure it out for myself and feel the confidence and strength to just say it. And part of that confidence and strength comes from other people around you bolstering you and saying, yes, like you have good ideas, keep it going.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's critical to have somebody in your corner. But ultimately, it is your voice. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, you are the one writing it. You're putting your name on it. And there's also this thing for a lot of people out there in the world, they can self-publish. Mm-hmm. There's this wonderful thing about self-publishing now, but you went, you know, it's great to go through a publisher though.
Yeah, that was not an option available to me for tenure right. purposes. You kind of have to go through a press and ideally a university press. But I can 100% understand the value, especially if you understand what your audience needs. Mm-hmm. And you are delivering that, then like, yeah, you should, yeah, having the confidence to self-publish it if you know you're meeting those needs, absolutely.
But even whereas, if you're self-publishing though, have a tribe around you. Like, you right. know, yeah. build a tribe you trust and listen. Because I think you run into more dangers if you're self-publishing because you're in your own echo chamber. So at least you had with you somebody, now you finally found somebody who believed in you mm-hmm. and who was responsive to you. So that I think makes all the difference in the world. You're trying to get some guidance.
It really did. And, you know, and I think I had great advisors and great mentors who certainly mm-hmm. were great cheerleaders who advocated for, you know, release time, removal from other types of responsibilities. I had amazing friends, two good friends of mine from grad school, Libby Anthony and Amy Reed, who I meet with all the time, and they'd read things and just tell me what they thought, right? Mm-hmm. I approached the book process like it was about me revising a document. And that's not, and writing a document, right? Like it feels like you and the page. And that's just part of it. That's not all of it. It's also this network of people who get you the resources, the support, the access to materials you might need, the feedback you need in order to really make sure that the what you're writing makes sense to someone outside of your brain. So it's really, you know, it feels like this linear, singular process, but it's actually like this big networked, circular process.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, after you found the new publisher and the responsive team, how long did that take then? Because up to now you're at 2 years, right? You're
plus 2 years plus.
Yeah. Yes. So right. now you found somebody. Right. Now how long does it take?
I know. I was trying to think. It's like, what were the key moments where I sat in my den and cried? I think that was in February, right? And so then by March, I was no longer crying. Like that feels very much like a time. But it was about 18 months by that point, between like kind of make 18 months to 2 years, between making the contact, getting it back out to reviewers, reviewers confirming what Tara said, which was that these revisions were not a good idea. It doesn't hang. And if you can instead focus on bolstering these strengths about the book, then it will be a thing. So once I had those reviews back, it was about 8 months before to make those revisions to go back. So that just shows you like 2 years to do something you don't want to do, 8 months to do a lot more work, but what I wanted to be doing, it just went faster. I resubmitted it.
I keep interrupting you, but you bring these really great, interesting points that I don't want people to miss on. And what you're talking about is, you know, when things were in the flow, when it felt right for you, right? Even, you know, you're taking advice and guidance from people, but it felt right. It flowed. Like 8 months as opposed to 2 years when you're trying to fight something and it's going against your grain. So your intuition is probably a really good guide. So if you're having a hard time, maybe you should stop and change your strategy, right? Maybe that's one indicator for other people out there who are trying to write something.
Yeah, absolutely. And please feel free to interrupt me at any point in time. You know, I'm a long talker, so no, I will talk until I am stopped. But yeah, absolutely. Like, and again, it was so much of what I was writing was just, what do you want me to, you know, like I was saying before, what do you want me to write? Sure, I'll write. I don't like, just like, let me keep my job. Like, just please, you know, like it felt very like not even, you know, just almost not magical, certainly, right? Like we imagine book writing to be.
Right, felt more desperate.
Yeah, desperate's the exact word. And once I got out of that headspace of just feeling like, I don't know what I have to say anymore, just, who knows if this makes any sense, and rather really sitting down and thinking, what kind of book do I really want to write? What will I be proud of? What do I really have to say about this thing? It wasn't until like that clicked that then I could actually start to put it together. And, you know, and then it went quickly. I mean, relatively speaking, it went much, much more quickly after that point.
Now, here's a question I have for you. It's one of the things when we're coaching writing teams, we often do an exercise about who are you writing to? Did you have that? Did you have that in mind as you were writing? Did you see the audience and incorporate that into your writing?
Yeah. And in fact, that was something that was a real challenge of moving from dissertation to book. In two ways. And I think everyone knows that, like, you write your dissertation to your committee to finish a PhD. Like that's exactly it.
You write it to academia.
Right.
Well, and your committee members in particular.
Right. Yes. Right. It's very particular. Right.
It's very specific.
Right.
That audience. Well, it is writing to personas then too. It's a completely different one. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I knew about that challenge. I knew that I'm going to have to stop writing to Kelly, Bernice, Paul, and Carolyn, and I have to write to other audience. But the thing I didn't know that I was just idealistic about, especially given my topic in vaccination, I had this picture of doctors will read this chapter and parents will read this chapter and public health professionals will read this other chapter. And so, to their credit, the reviewers found real problems in my earlier drafts. It wasn't like I had this great book that they just couldn't see. There were problems with it. And one of them was that I really thought, I was thinking too big. Like I was thinking like, oh, this is going to be like, you know, yeah. I mean, like I knew conceptually it would never be like at Barnes and Noble, but that's what you think of when you think of a book, right? Like all these different people who are the people who are going to pick it up. Right. And it took me a long time to learn that like an academic book by an academic press is going to be most primarily read by your former professors, their graduate students, and a couple of people who might listen to your topic and be really interested in it, right? Those are the people that you're really talking to. And I didn't quite get that that was really the audience that it was going back into. And I needed to make them happy first, at least. And if other people found it and were like, oh, this is cool, this is interesting. And that certainly has happened, especially, I think, given the pandemic, more people are encountering it because we have a question about vaccination now in ways that we didn't before. I think they are pulling useful things away, but they really are the secondary audience, at least of that book. Right. It was really about coming to terms with like, no, like the CDC, people at the CDC are not necessarily picking this up at Barnes and Noble, right? You know, that's not.
I thought she was going to be talking about it on CNN later on today.
So I think like,
he could be watching Room 42.
You never know. You never know. He has nothing else to do. So, right. But I think like, but you bring up a really great point, Janice, like personas, like developing personas would have been a really helpful strategy to use earlier in the process, and perhaps even to have talked through with a mentor, like, you know, someone who was helping me through that process, or even just like trying to see like, what's going on? Why is, because lots of people were like, what's going on? Where's the book? You know, and to think through like, you know, maybe having a conversation about, or going through the exercise of developing the personas of your readers would be really useful and valuable, just to see if you're actually thinking way too broad. And I know I was. Yeah. And prioritizing those personas too, like this group has to be satisfied. They're your gatekeepers. Yeah. And so like, you're not going to get to that hopeful Fauci audience without satisfying this first inner circle, you know, so what are their needs and address those, right? That would have been a really helpful way of perhaps identifying the flaws in my earlier strategy.
Yeah. We find it extremely helpful in the commercial world, especially when a lot of times people are like, well, everybody's my customer. And if you have a software, it's like, everybody's my customer. Well, not really. Let's talk about it. But you're like, when you thought about it, it's like, okay, well, really my primary audience, and that's what you need to speak to, because the rest are collateral, and you're going to pick up collateral. And hopefully some people here in Room 42 will pick up your book, because it's an interesting topic. And very
good.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it has been really interesting to, I have encountered and engaged with some doctors and public health folks who've read it or read parts of it, and I think I didn't know how to write to them anyway, because I think they respond to things that were not necessarily the most scientific or the most targeted toward them, but they like the stories, they like the interviews, they like reading about people, right? They like it because it is a little bit different than the kinds of things they're always reading. And so it does kind of show them that, oh, there's this other way of knowing and doing. And
storytelling is a really good way of getting points across, and it helps for relatability. Like, you know, people, it's part of the storytelling thing is I can see me in the story, then I can understand it. So I can imagine, you know, a doctor who's reading a lot of JAMA articles, right? And then now they're into like a story, and it's like the parable. So they can see a scenario where they're one part and their patient is the other part. So they can kind of fit into that scenario, and it gives them more depth of understanding.
Yeah. Yeah. And so even when you think that's a classic tech comm thing, right? If when you think you're addressing your audience's needs, you actually need to ask them what's working, what's interesting, what's helpful here. Yeah. And so one of the takeaways from there would be actually to not necessarily try to be like them and speak in their language, but rather, and it's something I take through all the collaborative work I do now, is this is what I bring to the table. Here are the methods I have. Here are the kinds of findings I can produce. Here are the types of questions I can answer, to really be plain and clear about like what the limits and capacities are of humanistic qualitative research. Mm-hmm. And the book writing process, which is why it's still like the most valuable and important and useful thing I've ever done, even though it was horrible, that allowed me to see that like, oh, this is what I can do. This is what the methods let me do. And to stop trying to do things other people wanted them to do, or to stop trying to say things with them that I didn't feel comfortable saying.
It's kind of funny. It's really interesting because you talk about this is part of, you have to do this in academia. It's a part of the tenure requirements in order to keep your job, you need to publish, right? Mm-hmm. But isn't it kind of funny that they made this one requirement for you because of the life lessons that you would learn from doing it? And that's like, you know, standing back and listening to you, that's one of the fascinating things is like, wow, you learned what you could never learn in 20 years in that short period of time from having to go through that battle, mm-hmm. right? Because it really is a battle. And when you're battle tested, you come out stronger.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's all really, really exceptionally said, Janice. Yeah, I was furious at my institution, my mm-hmm. own gatekeepers, my own. I was just rage all of the time. Why are you making me do this?
Rage against the machine.
Yeah, right. I also had articles, I had other metrics to evaluate my performance, and just felt like, you know, there's like, why do I have to do this thing? Why are you making me do this? And it really wasn't until even like 6 months after it came out. Like, I mean, it took a really long time for me to really go like, wow, this is something that was uniquely a unique writing experience, unique learning experience that you're right. I could have never learned it. I at least could have never learned it another way. And it has reach that academic articles that are mostly read by one group in one discipline do not always. Mm-hmm. It is something that people can buy on Amazon. You don't have to have a specialized user account that costs $1,000 in order to even read it or understand what it's about. And that just has given it, and rhetoric, I think, and the humanities, sort of more purchase and more understandability, more legibility in spaces like medicine, where we aren't always thought of so naturally, but that we really belong in.
Right. And that's the thing with a book has the potential to reach a lot more people than article, because articles tend to go into specialized, you know, even if they're published articles, they go into a specialized group, right? And that group may read it, and that might be a diverse group, but it's not like the whole world. Like if you put it out and it's like, you know, something you can go and buy on Amazon, or you can go, you know, order from a bookstore to get, it's very different.
Yeah. And it's something that I didn't get that part of it until it was
not in the beginning.
Yeah, no, right? In the beginning, you're like,
no, in the beginning you thought, well, I'll just take my dissertation, right? Add a few words, put a little structure around it, and it'll be done.
Yeah. Yeah. It'll be done and people will read it and it'll be great. I had very, you know, it's something I try to talk about as much as I can. And I'm just so glad that we've been able to talk about this today, because I wish that I'd had a little bit more of a realistic expectation going in. And I think it's the struggles that we have and the difficulties and our failures, right? These are not always the things we like to talk about. And so I try to be as plain with people as possible when they're like, what was it like writing a book? Like, awful and really hard and almost impossible. And like, not really clear what the value of it was until it was well done and over with. So, you know.
Right. Well, but I mean, was the journey worth it?
Oh, 100%. Yeah.
And do you think you really would have known going into this? Do you think you really would have heard other people saying, look, this is like a battle for your life and it's going to be, you will be put through the ringer. You're going to cry. You're going to want to give up. You will be angry and hostile.
Well, yeah, my husband and I actually started calling it the Voldemort Project, because people on campus would be like, how's the book? And it was just like automatic, like just like a little twitch that I'd get like, oh, don't ask me about my book. So he would just say, how's the Voldemort Project? And I'd be like, terrible as usual. I don't know. I think that, yeah, it's hard to hear those kinds of things, right? I mean, it's hard to think that that will actually happen to you. So anyone who's listening going like, okay, lady, but like my project is really good. And like, and for everybody like me, I'm sure there are like a million people who are like, what is she talking about? This was super easy for me, or I had no problem. And that's great, that to at least know that there's a diversity of experience, that not everyone is going to just sort of hit the ground running and have a book 18 months after you finish a dissertation, that you might, but also on the smorgasbord of things that can happen is like something that's just going to take a little longer, and it will all be worth it. And we'll all have learning associated with it. And we're all going to have different takeaways and experiences. And that doesn't make you, I mean, I don't feel like a lesser academic because my book took longer and was really hard for me to write. I feel like it's made me a lot better and a better teacher, a better writer. And so I feel like there's growth in all of it.
So do you think you'll write another one?
I cannot wait to.
Really?
Yep. I know. It's crazy. It's so stupid because like, I mean, I don't even like, I don't, you know, I know that like, who care, you know, like you start it all over. Like, it's not like I have some new voice where I'm like, oh, people are really interested in what I think. Like, it's not that. I think it is for that like challenge of like that long argument over 200 pages is, mine isn't quite that long, but could be longer, right? That's so hard. That's such a unique challenge to take on. Mm-hmm. And I do miss that component of it. I miss trying to like figure out the long argument and write and it just be me and just my voice and yet like sending it out to others and hearing their comments. And it is like, there's such a like a gratification in that process that even though I have like no book in me or whatever that people say, you know, I it's not like I have something that's like ready to go, but I can't wait.
Well, you're not fiction writing. So, you know, that's usually in fiction writing, it's like, you know, I have a book in me because it's like this in spirit thing.
Right.
A book will come to you, but when you're writing a book that's not fiction, and it is, you bring up a really good point. It's a long argument, right? And to sustain that argument with substance, you need to have a subject that really has that chutzpah, has the power behind it to be able to sustain it, right? To sustain itself somewhat while you compose the argument around it. So those don't like, you know, they're not like falling out of the tree. Like there's no, you know, but it will, you know, it'll come because you'll be working on things, right? Mm-hmm. You've got that book done. Now you know that journey.
Yeah. Yeah. And you just, you hope that it's, I mean, I don't really want to go through all of that again. Like I, you know, I don't want to relive it, but I, yeah, I think, you know, having learned so much, it would be fun to exercise those muscles again and see what it would be like for a second time and see how it would go. And and all those kinds of things. But it's definitely something that like, it can be so discouraging, but it's really worth it.
Yeah. And even if, you know, I think it's a good exercise for everybody to try to write a book.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, even if you never publish it or you never self-publish and no publisher picks you up, I think it's a good exercise in discipline because of all of the life lessons you learn in the process of writing the book. And it can be any kind of book. Right. But I think you learn some really good lessons in it.
Yeah, I agree. It feels very much in the vein of like everyone should work retail. Everyone should work in service, everyone should teach, everyone, you know, I think, you know, maybe not everyone, all of those things, but going through those kinds of experiences help you learn so many things about yourself and writing and communication and audiences. I'm so sorry. That, you know, are really important, for all of us as communicators. So yeah, I think if you have a book in you, or if you even a short story, articles, going through that publication process, finishing a piece of writing such that someone else reads it and wants to do something with it, there's just a learning process like none other in that experience.
Well, and I'll tell you, when you're working with an editor, they're like gold. Oh my God. The things they see, don't think they're going to see, and they see, it's like they're like magicians, if you ask me. I don't know. They're fantastic. But that experience, and when you're working with the editor who gets you, is really, I think it's a really, that's yeah. why I always encourage people, write an article, and write it for your trade, you know, mm-hmm. or if you want to write a book, go through that exercise, but get a team of editors and reviewers, because that's really where the life journey is, right? It sure, you've got this in you that you want to get out, but that journey in having those reviewers, it gives you a lot of insight for you, and it helps strengthen you.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, anytime you can get feedback on your writing, anytime you get another set of eyes, and we know that, right, from, you know, even a really simple set of FAQs, right? Someone else looks at it and says, what about this? Or what about that? And you go, oh, yep, that's really helpful. But to start like developing comfort with that networked experience of writing, with that collaborative experience of writing, stopping thinking of it as like, you know, just you and your thoughts and this like precious sort of thing.
Myself on the page. Oh my God.
yeah. You know, getting yourself away from those ideas, because that could be stopping things and you know, and just like constraining ideas and thoughts and possibilities for your writing. I see students do that all the time. It's always like so hard because I relate to it, and yet like know that they need to stop doing it, where they don't want to share a draft. They hold on to that draft, and they're like, but it's not done. It's not really done. And I'm like, literally, I care not what it looks like. Like, I don't care if it's a list of bullets misspelled all over the place. Like, it gives us something to work with. Like, just share the draft. And they're just like, no. And I'm like, I understand, I feel the same way, but we have to like let go of that as this like, I have to fix it all myself of writing, because that's just, I don't know, it can be a real problem for some.
Yeah, because it's nice being comfortable and warm and feeling secure, you know. It's a nice feeling, let's face it. And when you do write something and you give it to somebody else and they're reviewing it, they're editing it, they're going to make notes, they're going to make corrections, you're going to see, oh my God, I'm not perfect. Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh, Heidi, it has been so nice to talk to you. I've really enjoyed our conversations.
Oh, likewise.
I really hope that you write that next book.
Yeah.
Kind of like, it's kind of like those people who said, oh, you know, the first book was a breeze. It's like, yeah, write your second one and then tell me.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. You had a tough one on your first one. Your second one, you'll probably be like, oh, Janice, that was easy.
Right. Yeah. Or like my advisor, Bernice, said, I didn't really get my voice until I wrote my third book. So you're like, oh, wow. Just keep going. Just keep writing more books. And eventually,
there you go.
Yeah, well, thank you all so much for the invitation. This was really lovely to chat with you both, and this was a great conversation.
And hopefully you'll be back in room 42 again another time.